Hello, everyone. It is November the 29th of 2023, and this is part 7 of our ongoing series of Our Father and Our God. At the end of part 6, I'd suggested that folks have a read of Isaiah 53, and they might find that an interesting exercise to perform. I'd like to walk through that so that perhaps we can look at it in a new way, because it shows us much. Things I had not focused on before, and perhaps all of you have, and I'm just really late to the party, but so please bear with me if you would. In the past, at least for me, things were very much Christ-focused and not Father-focused. So sometimes the obvious was simply just overlooked. It was a classic look here and don't look there diversion. Since it's always a good idea to read some verses before a section, and after for that matter, let's begin by looking at Isaiah 52, verses 9 through 15. So let's begin with that, where it says, "Break into joy, sing together, you waste places of Jerusalem, for Jehovah has comforted his people. He has redeemed Jerusalem. Jehovah has made bare his holy arm in the eyes of the nations, and all the ends of the earth shall see the salvation of our God." So here we see that Jehovah and God are used interchangeably. That would be the supreme being. "Depart, depart, go out from there, touch no unclean thing, go out from the midst of her, be clean, you who bear the vessels of Jehovah. For you shall not go out with haste nor by flight, for Jehovah will go before you, and the God of Israel will be your rear guard. Behold, my servant," and servant is capitalized, "shall deal prudently. He shall be exalted and extolled and be very high." So here we have a case where Jehovah, our Father and our God, is talking about his servant. So in the Father's eyes, Christ is his servant. "And just as many were astonished as at you, so his visage was marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men." And we know the trial that Christ went through. So there is no mistake in this passage of who it is actually talking about. One of the things that I so appreciate out of Mark Mickelson's work is when you see both of those beings in the same text, then there's no mistaking who is who. That is a very powerful tool. And I would encourage you, as you walk through and do your own Bible study, when you see both the Father and the Son mentioned in the same text, take special note of that and see where it leads you. Going on. "So shall he," the Messiah, "sprinkle many nations. Kings shall shut their mouths at him. For what had not been told them, they shall see, and what they had not heard, they shall consider." So Lord here in the passage in 52 is the Father. And because Christ is referenced here, there shouldn't be any case of mistaken identity. Notice again that in Jehovah's eyes, Christ is his servant. The Trinity and the Binity concept seeks to hide that. And it does an awfully good job of that. Again, I was surprised when talking to a Protestant minister that it doesn't matter what the scriptures say, the default position is the Trinity, even though the Bible screams that that is not the case. This isn't a one-off where the Christ is referred to as God's servant. We go back to Isaiah 42 and let's take a look at verse 1. "Behold, my servant whom I uphold, my elect one in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him, and he will bring forth justice to the Gentiles." So there's no question that that's speaking of Christ directly. And again, we see that Jehovah refers to him as my servant. And again, in Jehovah's eyes, Christ is his servant, and in places referred to as his righteous servant, which we will see. If we sneak over into the New Testament, into Matthew 12, we'll go to Matthew 12, and we're going to see a confirmation of this servant identity in the passage in Matthew 12, and we'll read verses 15 through 28. Matthew 12, verses 15 through 28. But when Jesus knew it, he withdrew from there. The Pharisees were trying to kill him. And great multitudes followed him, and he healed them all. Yet he warned them not to make him known, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, which we just read, "Behold, my servant, whom I have chosen, my beloved, in whom my soul is well pleased, I will put my spirit upon him, and he will declare justice to the Gentiles. He will not quarrel, nor cry out, nor will anyone hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, and smoking flax he will not quench, till he sends forth justice to victory, and in his name Gentiles will trust." So we can see there exactly who that is. This alone should nullify the co-equal, co-eternal concept, which is the foundation of the binity or the Trinity. Christ is not a co-equal, he is the servant of the Most High. And Christ has always been Jehovah's servant. And Malachi 3:6 and Hebrews 13:8 tell us that neither the Father nor the Son change, and has always been his Son, as the firstborn of were shown in Colossians 1:15. Isaiah 42:1 is Jehovah speaking of his servant through Isaiah the prophet. We can go and see this again. We want to make sure that this is not a one-off of any kind, where we can go to Isaiah 49, and we'll read verses 5 to 7. "And now Jehovah says, who formed me from the womb to be his servant, to bring Jacob back to him so that Israel is gathered to him, for I shall be glorious in the eyes of Jehovah, and my God shall be my strength." So we can see here that this is God's servant speaking through Isaiah the prophet and telling him what he's been said, or what he's been told by the Father. "Indeed," he says, the Father says, "it is too small a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the preserved ones of Israel. I will also give you as a light to the Gentiles, that you should be my salvation to the ends of the earth. Thus says Jehovah, the Redeemer of Israel, their Holy One, to him whom man despises, to him whom the nation abhors." So that's the Father speaking to the Son, to the servant of rulers. "Kings shall see and arise, princes also shall worship, because of Jehovah who is faithful, the Holy One of Israel, the Father, and he, the Father, has chosen you, his servant." Christ is the Father's servant. With that in mind, let's go to Isaiah 53 and look at this passage. Anyway, it's common in our history to go through certain sections of Isaiah 53 to point Christ out, and indeed Christ is in the text. But we need to look a little bit further and step back from that rather myopic view and look at the entire text as we might. So let's go on here in Isaiah 53. "Who has believed our report? And to whom has the arm of Jehovah been revealed?" Well, if you look up the word arm, it's the Hebrew word 2220, and it means arm, shoulder, or strength. Jehovah here is the Father, from verse 2 on, and it's obviously referring to Christ. So, he, the Messiah, shall grow up before him, the Father, as a tender plant and as a root out of dry ground. He has no form or comeliness, and when we see him, there's no beauty that we should desire him. He's despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we did not esteem him. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement for our peace was upon him, and by his stripes we are healed. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. And Jehovah has laid on him, the Messiah, the servant, the iniquity of us all. So we can see the Father acting here as the quarterback for the whole thing. And I can't believe that I just didn't pay any attention to that. I just didn't look at it for all those years, which to me is just quite amazing. Lord here is the Father. You can see that. Let's go on here in verse 7. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, obviously Christ, yet he opened not his mouth. He was led as a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. He was taken from prison and from judgment, and who will declare his generation? For he was cut off from the land of the living for the transgressions of my people. Obviously the Father talking here. He was stricken. And they made his grave with the wicked, but with the rich at his death, because he had done no violence, nor was there any deceit in his mouth. He was God's Holy One. Yet it pleased Jehovah to bruise him. Well, we need to stop and think about that. It pleased the Father to bruise him. He, the Father, has put him to grief. When you, the Father, make his soul, the Messiah, an offering for sin. He shall see his seed, he shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of Jehovah shall prosper in his hand. So here we can see in the text both the Father and his servant, and it's not difficult to see that. He shall see the labor of his soul and be satisfied. He was sent on a mission from the Father, which he completed as his servant. By his knowledge, my righteous servant, so here we see it again, he was the Holy One who was made flesh and dwelt among us. By his knowledge, my righteous servant shall justify many, for he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore I, the Father, will divide him, the Messiah, a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul unto death, and he was numbered with the transgressors, and he bore the sin of many, and made intercession for the transgressors. So we can see by reading through Isaiah 15, the Father's direct involvement in the narrative and speaking about Christ and what he would do, and the Father will divide him a portion with the great and divide the spoil with the strong, because he completed and he fulfilled his task, as we see in verse 12. We can see a snapshot of exactly what he did in that particular passage. So, you know, when we step back from that and actually look at it to see how Christ was used by the Father to make intercession for the transgressors and to bear the sin of many, it opens up our understanding to the mind of the Father and also the mind of his servant through whom he operated. We really see in verses 10 through 12 Jehovah's servant through that passage. Remember in the New Testament when Christ said, "Is there no other way?" And we just read what he went through. But as a human being, that's not a real pleasant experience that he went through. So we look at Christ in Matthew 26, and we're going to read verses 31 through 44. As a human being, or being made a human being, he had some obvious thoughts. I think all of us would have that. So let's go and read Matthew 26, verses 31 through 44. "Then Jesus said to them, 'All of you will be made to stumble because of me this night, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd,'" I'm quoting Zechariah 13, "'and the sheep of the flock will be scattered.'" So this is the Father then allowing his servant Christ to be stricken, and that the apostles would, or the disciples, soon to be apostles, would simply be scattered because of that situation. "But after I have been raised, I will go before you to Galilee. And Peter answered and said to him, 'Even if we are all made to stumble because of you, I will never be made to stumble.' And Christ said to him, 'Assuredly, I say to you that this night, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times.' Peter said to him, 'Even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you.' And so said all the disciples." Well, they were all in the strong opinion that they could handle it. "Then Jesus came with them to a place called Gethsemane and said to his disciples, 'Sit here while I go and pray over there.' And he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, and he began to be sorrowful and deeply distressed. And then he said to them, 'My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch with me.'" So as a human, they had this pall of things coming coming over him as he knew what he was going to go through. "He went a little further and fell on his face and prayed, saying, 'Oh, my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will.'" This shows us that Christ had a will of his own, and that he willingly subjected it to the will of the Father. That's very important. "Then he came to the disciples and found them sleeping and said to Peter, 'What? Could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak.'" So we can see that internal struggle that Christ had. "Again, a second time, he went away and prayed, saying, 'Oh, my Father, if this cup cannot pass away from me unless I drink it, your will be done.' And he came and found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy. So he left them and went away again and prayed the third time, saying the same words." So you can see that as a human being, and having a will of his own, what he was wrestling with, knowing what he would have to go through. And that, I think, is very, very interesting. He did have a will of his own. Well, I thought they were of one spirit. Didn't they have the same spirit? Nope, they sure didn't. Christ did, in fact, have a will of his own, different from the Father's, but that he subjected it to the same as the Father's will. That is, being a separate being with one's own will, but choosing to be at one with the Father and his purpose. It is why Christ identified his brothers and sisters as those who do the will of the Father, all the while having their own will as separate and distinct beings. This will be the essence of being a son of God when resurrected to spirit. A separate and distinct being, but your individual will be subjected to that of our Father. Isaiah 66, verses 1 and 2, says, "Thus says Jehovah, heaven is my throne and earth is my footstool. Where's the house that you build for me? And where's the place of my rest? For all those things my hand has made, and all those things exist, says Jehovah." He is the Creator. "But on this one will I look, on him who is poor and of a contrite spirit, and who trembles at my word." That would be the folks that submit their will to the will of the Father. The mental disposition, or the spirit, that's one of the meanings of spirit, of a son of God, or the son of God, is actually spoken of in Isaiah 11, verses 1 through 5. Isaiah 11, verses 1 through 5. Like, what was the spirit of Christ all about? The whole idea that the Father and the Son are of the same spirit, the same mental disposition, is simply not true. Let's go to Isaiah 11, verses 1 through 5. "There shall come forth a rod from the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots," speaking of the coming physical birth of the Messiah. "The Spirit of Jehovah," again, we see both of them in the text here, and we need to look at that and think it through. "The Spirit of Jehovah shall rest upon him." So the Spirit of the Father, the Creator, will rest upon him. Well, what kind of a spirit did Christ actually have? The Father gave him his spirit, the way he thinks, the bank of information that the Father had. So he gave Christ the spirit of wisdom and understanding. We looked at how God can arbitrarily just put that into anybody anytime he wants. The spirit of counsel and might, the spirit of knowledge. Those would be pretty useful tools to face Satan, don't you think? And notice, and of the fear of Jehovah. The mental disposition of Christ contained wisdom, understanding, counsel, might, and knowledge, but it also contained an attitude of the fear of Jehovah, exactly as we read in Isaiah 66. And his delight, you know, his attitude, his delight is in the fear of Jehovah. "And he shall not judge by the sight of his eyes, nor decide by the hearing of his ears, but with righteousness he shall judge the poor." The Father set up Christ's spirit so he knew exactly what he would do. He had total confidence in the mission that he sent him on. "But with righteousness he'll judge the poor and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. He shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall slay the wicked. Righteousness shall be the belt of his loins, and faithfulness the belt of his waist." The Spirit of the Father and the Spirit of the Son are not the same. Jehovah has no fear of Jehovah. The Binity concept hides this. Jehovah has no fear of himself. The Son does. And it is the delight of the Son to be in the fear of Jehovah. Does it make sense that additional sons of God when brought forth as spirit beings, will have a similar mindset to Christ. When and if we realize that Jehovah is our Father, and that is His name, Scripture comes alive in many ways that we may well not have considered previously. So, let's get back to our study of Job. Now that we understand a little bit more about the Father and the Son, and again, a heads up to everybody, when you're reading your Bible, you know, if you're looking for the Father in the Old Testament, He's everywhere. And if you're looking for the Son in the Old Testament, look for the servant, for that is, in fact, who He is. We'd gone along and we were in Job 40, verse 15. So we'll pick it up there. The Father again speaking to Job. It says, "Look now at the behemoth, which I made along with you. He eats grass like an ox." We now understand a bit more as to how Jehovah creates. He sends forth His spirit and His breath, and things actually begin to happen. And that's been a very powerful tool for me personally to understand how He does that. And the scriptures such as Revelation 4 and verse 11 have really come alive in a quantum leap in an understanding. Let's read that. Revelation 4:11 says, "You are worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power, for You," this is the Father, "created all things," and we now know how He does that, "and by Your will they exist and were created. The created begin as thoughts in the mind of the Creator. His spirit and His breath then flow from Him to create at any time. He can create or He can uncreate. And all created are subject to the will of the Creator, the one true God." So we'll go on and we'll continue to read Job with this in mind. There's a force that flows from the Father, as we see as His spirit and His breath, to build anything He wants at any time He wants for whatever purpose He wants. That's what creators actually do. "See now, His strength is in His hips," this is the behemoth, "and His power is in His stomach muscles. He moves His tail like a cedar, the sinews of His thighs are tightly knit. His bones are like the beams of bronze, His ribs like bars of iron. He is the first of the ways of God, only He who made Him can bring near His sword." Incredibly powerful being, or beast. "Surely the mountains yield food for Him, and all the beasts of the field play there. He lies under the lotus trees in a covert of reeds and marsh. The lotus trees cover Him with their shade, the willows by the brook surround Him. Indeed, the river may rage, yet He is not disturbed. He's confident, though the Jordan gushes into His mouth. And though He takes it in His eyes, or one pierces His nose with a snare." Incredibly powerful being that the Father built with a thought and then proceeded to make such a beast. Going on, and you notice there's an increasing level of God's capacity and His ability, where we move from behemoth to the Leviathan. "Can you draw out Leviathan with a hook or snare his tongue with a line which you lower? Can you put a reed through his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make many supplications to you? Will he speak softly to you? Will he make a covenant with you? Will you take him as a servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird, or will you leash him for your maidens? Will your companions make a banquet of him? Will they apportion him among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hand on him, remember the battle. Never do it again. Indeed, any hope of overcoming him is false. And shall one not be overwhelmed at the sight of him? No one is so fierce that he would dare stir him up. Who then is able to stand against me? The one who made him is so much further in terms of power than the one who was made. Who has preceded me that I should pay him? Well, who preceded the Father? Well, no one. Everyone under heaven is mine. Or everything under heaven is mine, I'm sorry. I will not conceal his limbs, his mighty power, or his graceful proportions. Who can remove his outer coat, and who can approach him with a double bridle? Who can open the doors of his face with his terrible teeth all around? His rows of scales are his pride, shut up tightly as with a seal. One is so near another that no air can come between them. They are joined one to another. Well, who engineered this being? Well, it would be God the Father. Going on. They're joined one to another. They stick together and cannot be parted. His sneezings flash forth light, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. Out of his mouth go burning lights. Sparks of fire shoot out. Smoke goes out of his nostrils, as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals, and a flame goes out of his mouth. Strength dwells in his neck, and sorrow dances before him. The folds of his flesh are joined together. They are firm on him and cannot be moved. His heart is as hard as stone, even as hard as the lower millstone. When he raises himself up, the mighty are afraid. Because of his crashings, they are beside themselves. Though the sword reaches him, it cannot prevail, nor does spear, dart, or javelin. He regards iron as straw and bronze as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. Sling stones become like stubble to him. Darts are regarded as straw. He laughs at the threat of javelins. His undersides are like sharp potsherds. He spreads pointed marks in the mire. He makes the deep boil like a pot. He makes the sea like a pot of ointment. He leaves a shining wake behind him. One would think the deep had white hair. On earth there is nothing like him, which is made without fear. So, this beast, is God didn't give it any fear at all. He beholds every high thing. He is king over the children of pride. And some have used that this is an allegory for Satan himself. And I couldn't fault that. But could God create a being exactly like that? Well, of course he could. And Job finally came to that understanding. We'll read that of where he got to in Job 42, verses 1 through 6. Job answered Jehovah and said, I know that you can do everything, and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. Do we actually get that? You asked, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me which I did not know. You know, we all, I guess in our own way, think we actually know something. And when we stack up against God himself, our creator, we don't make too big of a ripple on the pond, regardless of what we think we know. And Job came to understand that. Listen, please, and let me speak. You said, I will question you, and you shall answer me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear. You know, we hear about God. But now my eye sees you. He actually saw the space and the capability of his God up close and personal, and he was a bit overwhelmed by it. Therefore I abhor myself, and I repent in dust and ashes. Job came to understand that God will make what he wants to, when he wants to, and then how he wants to, whenever he pleases to. As humans, although we might think otherwise, we really don't make too big a splash in the grand scheme of things. Job came to understand where he fit in that grand scheme of thing, and it's likely a good idea that we consider doing the same. You know, we can see the footprints of God, Jehovah, our Creator, now that we might know what to look for. And we're going to take a look at that in the little book of Jonah, where we can actually learn some things from Jonah. And it's not so much the story that we're going to be paying attention to, but to the actions and the capabilities of our Creator. When we know who Jehovah is, it does make a difference to our read. So let's go on. Now, the word of Jehovah came to Jonah as the son of Amittai, saying, "Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and cry out against it, for their wickedness has come up before me." This is not Christ. This is Jehovah, our Father. But Jonah arose to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. And I looked up the word presence just out of curiosity, because I really didn't know what that meant, because it's used several times. Panim is the Hebrew word, 6440, and it means the face of the Lord. So, however God chose to deliver that message to him, it's not clear in the text to me, but obviously he knew exactly what was going on. He didn't like the idea of being the servant of God in that case. He went down to Joppa, and he found a ship going to Tarshish. So he paid the fare and went down into it to go with them to Tarshish from the presence of Jehovah. He was getting out of Dodge. But Jehovah sent out a great wind on the sea. So is the Father able to interfere or use the processes of the earth to bring about a situation? Well, of course he is. He sent out a great wind on the sea, and there was a mighty tempest, so that the ship was about to be broken up. So he turned up the dial to where things were getting serious. Then the mariners were afraid, and every man cried out to his God. So obviously these people knew nothing of the true God, but they had a view of God in their minds. And they threw the cargo that was in the ship into the sea to lighten the load. But Jonah had gone down into the lowest parts of the ship and had lain down and was fast asleep. So the captain came to him and said to him, "What do you mean, sleeper? Arise, call on your God. Perhaps your God will consider us so that we may not perish." So you can imagine what's rolling around in the sailor's mind. Like, this is pretty serious stuff. And they said to one another, "Come, let us cast lots, that we may know for whose cause this trouble has come upon us." And I got thinking, in today's society, if the weather just went all weird, would today's society even consider that God had a hand in it? And I'm thinking, no, I don't think so. So they cast lots, and the lot fell on Jonah. Then they said to him, "Please tell us, for whose cause is this trouble upon us? What is your occupation? Where do you come from? What's your country? And of what people are you?" So he said to them, "I'm a Hebrew, and I fear Jehovah, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land." So Jonah had the understanding of who the Creator actually was. Then the men were exceedingly afraid and said to him, "Why have you done this?" For the men knew that he fled from the presence of Jehovah because he had told them. Just imagine that. You hop on a ship and you tell somebody that you're fleeing because God gave you an assignment to do and you're just getting out of town. How do you think the sailors of today would respond to such an individual? Like, put yourself in that situation. Would they not think he's a nutcase? I'm thinking. Then they said to him, "What shall we do to you that the sea may be calm for us? For the sea has been growing more tempestuous." And he said to them, "Pick me up, throw me into the sea, that the sea will Then the sea will become calm for you, for I know that this great tempest is because of me. He'd joined the dots. He'd figured it out. Nevertheless, the men rowed hard to return to land, but they could not, for the sea continued to grow more tempestuous against them. Therefore, they cried out to Jehovah. There's been a transformation from verse 5 to verse 14, where God obviously had come into their thoughts, and they understood who God really was. They cried out to Jehovah and said, "We pray, O Jehovah, please do not let us perish for this man's life, and do not charge us with innocent blood, for you, Jehovah, have done as it pleased you." They were getting the picture. So they picked up Jonah and threw him into the sea, and the sea ceased from its raging. Well, wouldn't that be a powerful sign to witness? Then the men feared Jehovah exceedingly and offered a sacrifice to Jehovah and took vows. Well, I wonder what those vows would actually be. But again, you know, they see this great miracle. They see the capability of the God who made the universe. Then Jonah prayed to Jehovah his God from the fish's belly. You know, the Lord had prepared, sorry, I missed verse 17, Jehovah had prepared a great fish to swallow Jonah. Well, we now know how he did that. He simply created one, a very special fish, and Jonah was in the belly of the fish for 3 days and three nights. Then Jonah prayed to the Lord his God from the fish's belly. So he, obviously he's still conscious. He's not dead. So God made a special creature. And he said, "I cried out to Jehovah because of my affliction, and he answered me. Out of the belly of Sheol I cried, and you heard my voice. For you cast me into the deep, into the heart of the seas. The floods surrounded me. All your billows and your waves passed over me. And then I said, I have been cast out of your sight, yet I will look again towards your holy temple. The waters surrounded me, even to my soul. The deep closed around me. Weeds were wrapped around my head. And I went down to the moorings of the mountains. The earth with its bars closed behind me forever. Yet you have brought me up. You have brought up my life from the pit, Jehovah, my God. When my soul fainted within me, I remembered Jehovah, and my prayer went up to you into the holy temple. Those who regard worthless idols forsake their own mercy." Going into idolatry is a very bad thing for all of us. God is merciful to those who do not. "But I will sacrifice to you with the voice of thanksgiving. I will pay what I have vowed. Salvation is of Jehovah." So he understood that. And here salvation is referred to as being of the Father. So here we see again a capacity of God. So Jehovah spoke to the fish, and it vomited Jonah onto dry land. Well, what human being would have such control to do that? Now the word of Jehovah came to Jonah the second time, so he repeats the message. "Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and preach to it the message that I tell you." So Jonah arose and went to Nineveh according to the word of Jehovah. He got the message. Now Nineveh, he was going to be a servant of God now. Nineveh was an exceedingly great city, 3 day journey in extent. Jonah began to enter the city on the first day's walk. Then he cried out and said, "Yet 40 days, and Nineveh shall be overthrown." So the people of Nineveh believed God, proclaimed a fast, and put on sackcloth from the greatest of them to the least of them. What if somebody went into New York City, just as an example, and said something like that today? How do you think that would be received? Then word came to the king of Nineveh, and he rose from his throne, laid aside his robe, covered himself with sackcloth and sat in ashes, and he caused it to be proclaimed and published throughout Nineveh by the decree of the king and his nobles, saying, "Let neither man nor beast, herd nor flock, taste anything. Don't let them eat or drink water, but let man and beast be covered with sackcloth and cry mightily to God." Can you imagine that happening today in one of our cities? Yes, let everyone turn from his evil way and from the violence that is in his hands. Who can tell if God will turn and relent and turn away from his fierce anger so that we may not perish? These guys actually believed it. Then God saw their works, that they turned from their evil way, and God relented from the disaster that he had said he would bring upon them, and he did not do it. So our Creator, when he delivers the message to us, pays attention to our response to it. But it displeased Jonah exceedingly, and he became angry. So he prayed to Jehovah and said, "Ah, Jehovah, was not this what I said when I was still in my country? Therefore I fled previously to Tarshish, for I know that you are a graceful and merciful God, slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness, one who relents from doing harm. Now therefore, Jehovah, please take my life from me, for it's better for me to die than to live." And then Jehovah said, "Is it right for you to be angry?" So he's paying specific attention to Jonah's mental disposition, his spirit, and throwing some questions at him. So Jonah went out of the city, sat on the east side of it, and there he made himself a shelter and sat under it in the shade till he might see what would become of the city. And Jehovah, Elohim, the Father, prepared a plant and made it come up over Jonah that it might be shade for his head to deliver him from his misery. We now know the process by which that occurred. And Jonah was very grateful for the plant. But as morning dawned the next day, God, the Creator, prepared a worm, and it so damaged the plant that it withered. You can see from God's perspective as the Creator, he does what he wants when he wants, showing Jonah the space that he occupied. And it happened when the sun arose that God prepared a vehement east wind. So again we see the capacity of the Creator. He brings about a violent east wind. The sun beat on Jonah's head so that he grew faint. Then he wished death for himself and said, "It's better for me to die than to live." Then God said to Jonah, "Is it right for you to be angry about the plant?" And he said, "It is right for me to be angry even to death." So we get a snapshot of what's rolling around in Jonah's head. But Jehovah said, "You've had pity on the plant for which you have not labored." God built it for him. "Nor made it grow, which came up in a night and perished in a night. And should I not pity Nineveh, the great city, in which there are more than 120,000 persons who cannot discern between their right hand and their left? The Father did not give them wisdom. He did not give them knowledge. He did not give them the things that Christ was given. And the Father said, they don't know their right hand from their left. Is it not because he made them that way? It is not in man to direct his steps. And yet here we see the Creator showing great mercy to these people when they repented of their situation. And asking Jonah, you know, Jonah pitied the plant. Should God not pity these people who can't discern between their right hand and their left, situation in which he created them, and much livestock? So, when we read Jonah, we can see these actions of the Creator, Jehovah, doing these various things, controlling the weather, working with the attitudes of the mariners, revealing himself to them, building a plant, building a worm. And you can see how you and I, as human beings, really don't make much of an imprint, and yet we're certainly going to. In due course. Well, is it within Jehovah's creative capacity then to create a being who is uncorrupt and incorruptible? And you might want to go to thesaurus.com and type in the word uncorrupt, because it is a bit of an education. He made the angels corruptible, and he made man corruptible. Did he do so because he cannot make something incorruptible like himself? What about that? We'll look at that in part 8.